Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome to Seriously, the podcast from The New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
This week we're going to be talking about the new series of Aziz Ansari's Master of None and the BBC Three comedy Can't Cope, Won't Cope.
We've also listened to the Black Tapes podcast for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to Seriously. We're looking through some of your emails, as we want to do. Emaily. We've got one from Alex here, who gets in touch about Riverdale, because they say that while they enjoyed our review, they don't say that, but I'm going to say that, while they enjoyed our review, they have to disagree on the point that it's a poor fusion of many different genres. Alex says, the genius of the show is that it's a brilliant meta-commentary on visual culture. Because it merges things like In Cold Blood, Twin Peaks, Fatal Attraction, Elizabethan Revenge Tragedy, Heathers, The Breakfast Club, all these different aesthetics. And Alex says it's therefore brilliantly self-aware as a piece of visual culture. And I think that earns it endless praise. For me, all those things are like so iconic in their aesthetics and so like very well defined, like Heathers. Heathers is one of my favourite movies of all time. And Riverdale's just not quite as individual as any of those things. By merging them, it kind of just becomes this weird, like, what is this show?
The more I've thought about Riverdale since we did our review on a few episodes ago, the more I feel that maybe it is a Netflix by numbers commission, in the way that we've read about other shows where Netflix have commissioned something because it's in a genre that they already have things that are really popular to stream, and it stars actors whose stuff is already really popular on Netflix.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether Riverdale doesn't check a demographic box for them. It's a comic book adaptation, it has a crime element, and it has, as you say, aesthetics that go with really popular things already. And I don't know, that's made me think slightly less of it.
Yeah, and it hovers in that space, doesn't it, between something like Twin Peaks, which is so over the top, melodramatic, stylized to the point that you're kind of laughing at it a bit and it knows it. Riverdale's kind of in between because it's trying to do that and also be like a compelling normal teen drama at the same time, which,
and be very serious. It takes itself far too seriously.
But I'm still watching it. Lol.
Yeah, true.
I would still go to like a Riverdale finale viewing party.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've got an email there, I see.
I do. I have a lovely email from Felicity, who gets in touch to say, a classic long-time listener, first-time emailer from Australia here. I thought you would appreciate these amazing Monument Valley cosplay pictures. And she sends us a link, which we'll also post on our Twitter and stuff, which, yeah, shows some people dressed as amazing characters from the mobile game Monument Valley, including the central girl.
Yeah.
The thing. It's
amazing.
Really exciting. I maybe ignorantly did not realise people did cosplay from mobile games.
Yeah, well, Monument Valley cosplay is not something I would have like expected to see, but I'm glad that it exists. So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Master of None, the Netflix series from comedian Aziz Ansari, co-written with Alan Yang. It debuted on the streaming service back in 2015, and the second series begins with the out-of-work actor Dev, played by Ansari, having moved from New York to Italy to study pasta making. So Master of None, it's kind of been gone for a long time because it's one of those Netflix comedy dramas, or just comedies, I guess, really, that you, for me, that was one of the like top ones that I'm like, oh yeah, really enjoyed that series, really wanted to come back, like looking forward to its return. And then it took slightly longer, I think, than most of Netflix's other original stuff to come back. It's not like it's on this fixed yearly cycle like some of the other things like Love or Orange is the New Black or whatever.
Yeah, totally. I I'm not really sure the reasons for that. I don't know, maybe Ansari had other stuff on in between them and he couldn't get on with the second series of Master of None straight away. But yeah, it has been away for a while. Also, I think the way that Netflix drops all the episodes in one go exacerbates that feeling of feeling distant from something in the past, especially if, like me, you binge through all of the first series in like 2 weeks. You don't have that, because there were 10 episodes in the first series. If I had watched one a week, that would have taken up like 2.5 months or something, and it would have felt like a more solid period of time that I'd spent with the show. But yeah, so it's been away for a while. It now returns for a difficult second series, if you can say that about TV. And I've seen the first 2 episodes of the new series. You've seen 3.
Yeah. So I think if you're listening to this on Tuesday, it comes out this Friday. I mean, I was tempted to just power through all of it, to be honest, because it's one of those shows that I find so watchable.
It's very consumable, isn't it?
Yeah. Because it's kind of like light, fluffy, funny, and yeah, bite-sized. It's just great. So the series starts with, you know, no spoilers. We're not going to spoil you dramatically before it starts, but we open in Italy in black and white.
Yeah, so the first episode is probably, I would guess, as close as Master of None is going to get to a bottle episode. And it's not a strict bottle episode in the sense that the characters aren't contained in a particular room or device. But, you know, we see Dev Ansari's character completely out of the context we last saw him in, which was New York. He's living in a fairly small Italian city. He's learning to make pasta. He's an apprentice at a cafe or restaurant learning to make pasta. And I think, doesn't it just follow the action of one day, which is his birthday? He's made some friends in this new town, particularly love his friendship with the young boy, the grandson of the woman he's learning pasta making from. He is excellent.
He says things like, "Your Italian is awful." It is mostly subtitled, this episode as well, as well as being in black and white. So yeah, it's literally like Master of None goes art house European movie.
Yeah, goes Fellini or something. Yeah. And I really enjoyed that. And I think it was a bold but good decision they made to say from the outset, we want to do other things with the show. We're not going to become a formulaic New York comedy.
Yeah. I think we said this in our discussion of the first season. You get this like thematic sense of like, this episode deals with this, this episode is about this. And I think that for me, that's exacerbated even by like every time they have a different episode title card and it's in a different font and a different style each time. And it's a bit like Master of None goes to Hollywood or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's like that very specific vibe. And so, yeah, I agree. I quite liked these. One thing that I had forgotten about Master of None, and I think I'm like absolutely in the minority on this opinion, is that I find it very like stilted. I don't find the acting particularly naturalistic often at points. And I find I find it a bit like, hey, what are you doing today? And you're like, wait, this kind of feels a bit like an infomercial, or like, do you get that vibe from it at all?
I do know what you mean. And it didn't actually really dawn on me until I watched the second episode. Because I think in the first episode, quite a lot of it is covered up by Ansari's slightly self-parodying way of speaking Italian. Because obviously he's playing an American that is like learning Italian, who's pretty fluent, but obviously he's slightly taking the mick out of himself all the time when he's doing Italian style gestures or pronunciations. You know, he particularly this word allora, which means well at the start of a sentence, and every time he says that word he does it in a more exaggerated and fake Italian sounding way.
And so they don't give you the subtitles for it, so that you don't know what it means either, because he doesn't know what it means for the first half of the episode, which I thought was quite clever.
But so then in the second episode, we're in more conventional Master of None territory, in the sense that it's back in colour. One of his friends from New York has come over to attend a wedding in Tuscany. Mm-hmm. We're back on relationships, both romantic and friend-based ones. And, you know, the themes of getting older and feeling like you haven't achieved much yet and all this kind of stuff. And suddenly I did find it quite stilted, I think, is the word.
I think there's also moments, and I get this in other programs, where when I see British people talking to American people on screen, I find it really weird, because like I normally am either watching like British accented stuff or American accented stuff, and when the two come together, I'm like, wait, is this like is there a fakeness at work here? Which one of you's got the like fake voice? I can't tell. So that's just like obviously my brain being weird. But then there are moments in this where people are like making plans or like fake introductions of characters, another thing in this program that I find quite not that naturalistic. But then it's a very stylized show, as we were saying. Like, every episode is sort of like themed and like specific in some way. So maybe it just doesn't need that. And it doesn't make it any less watchable for me.
No, it doesn't. And the only point where I got even mildly irritated with it was in the second episode, when they're at this wedding and it's his friend Arnold's ex's wedding. And Arnold behaved really badly, because when he first gets to the wedding, he goes up to the bride and is like, "I've always loved you. We should have been together. Why are you going out with a man who looks like me but shorter, etc., etc.?" And obviously she's really devastated because he's just been a total dick to her on her wedding day. And then later, then there's a montage of him and Dev going off and like eating some nice pasta and cheese. And then when they come
like sacking off the wedding for a bit.
And then when they come back, Arnold just like, "I'm going to make a speech now," even though nobody asked me to. Yeah. And instead of Arnold's speech being like embarrassing and a bit weird, and there being the sense that he's sort of destroyed the event with his selfishness, instead he makes his quite self-involved speech about, you know, "We used to be together, but now we're different people, and I really wish you well with that.
I actually want good things for you because I'm a good person. I just want everyone here to know that."
Yeah. And instead of him being like punished in the meta narrative of the show for that, all the characters are like, "Oh, Arnold, well done." And the bride's like hugging him and, "Mate, you did such a good job," and all this kind of thing.
The bride barely gets a line as well.
I know. So that made me feel a bit like, well, this is just a very, very almost like classic 70s sitcom way of dealing with this conflict.
Yeah.
I am disappointed by this.
Yeah. But I enjoyed the sort of montage of them like having a nice
That's
time and like the Italian stuff. Like,
it's so charming. All of it is so charming.
Yeah. And I really like those little things where they do focus in on like a little kind of like linguistic quirk that you actually think probably is quite natural to the like the people working on it. So when they say like, "Eating in Italy is my favorite thing," they keep saying that like over and over again and like singing little songs to that tune. And I like that, because that to me is, yeah, there's just something really genuine and warm about it. So I like that. So in the third episode, from what I've seen, it's from the third episode that we're back in New York.
Right, okay.
And I really liked the Italian interlude, but I'm kind of glad that the rest of the series, I think, is going to take place in New York, and Dev gets this new job. I don't know if you see that at the end of the second episode.
Yeah, he gets a job hosting a cupcake-based bake-off show, right?
Yeah, it's like a kind of more gaudy, is that the right word, version of the Bake Off, less twee and more colourful. But yeah, so I'm excited to see where the series goes, where Dev's love life goes. Want to catch up with that.
Yeah, I think no matter what else happens in the show, I just really enjoy spending half an hour at a time with Aziz Ansari.
Yeah, definitely. And this is like, it's a rom-com, and we love rom-coms on Seriously, so this is just irresistible for that alone.
Sull'eco del concerto che insieme ci trovò, ripeterò ancor la strada che mi porta a te.
Now we're going to talk about Can't Cope, Won't Cope, which is a coming-of-age drama on BBC Three about two young women in Dublin. It follows Aisling and Danielle as they navigate their early 20s and the booze-fueled life that they have built for themselves.
Yeah, before we even get onto this show, I have to say, is the title, right, is a reference to this British cooking show called Can't Cook, Won't Cook?
I was wondering about this as well, which is like a daytime TV.
With like Ainsley Harriott and all these other like sort of third tier celebrity British chefs.
See, now I get that show confused with Ready Steady Cook, which is the one that had peppers and red tomatoes.
So that was Ready Steady Cook.
I think that one's Ready Steady Cook, but Can't Cook, Won't Cook was definitely on basically identical format.
What was Can't Cook, Won't Cook?
I think Can't Cook, Won't Cook was when, maybe it was like Fern Was it Fern Cotton?
Apparently it
or
was.
Or Fern Britton.
No, it was Ainsley Harriott, thank God, because okay. He's my idol, that was broadcast on BBC One on weekday mornings, usually after the breakfast news. Two chefs, one of whom could not cook and one of whom would not cook. Genuine line from Wikipedia, were nominated by a friend or relative to cook a meal under the instructions of a world-class chef. So I think the two chefs of the beginning of that sentence are just like normals.
Contestants, right.
Yeah. When the dish was cooked, the nominator would be blindfolded and asked to taste the food. Yeah. Following this, they would decide whose dish was best. In the event of a tie, the aforementioned chef would decide. That's brilliant. So yeah, I just find that so weird that they would be like, right, we're going to make this show and we're just going to like call it Can't Cope, Won't Cope in reference to this like 90s British cooking show.
Yeah, it's really funny. So in the publicity blurb for this show, which is I think it's the first episode is already on iPlayer and I think there's going to be one a week for 6 weeks now. Mm-hmm. The publicity material for it says this is a millennial coming of age drama.
Yeah.
And you will be in no doubt about this once you've watched the title card for it, because it's it's in millennial pink and it has animations of mobile phones and other things that millennials like.
So after you've seen that title card, it like cuts to Aisling in her office being like, the alcohol is sweating out of me, like, and you're like, okay, got it. Rowdy drinker.
Yeah, so I watched this with my housemate Danny, who is an actual Irish person from actual Dublin, who was...
Human Dublin person.
...was able to explain some of the things about the show, but she also found it pretty baffling in other respects. So her best theory about who the girls are, she reckons that they're not from Dublin, that they are from somewhere else in the country and they've moved to Dublin.
Right.
This is based on their accents.
So these two Irish girls live together in a sort of house share, or is it flat share? I can't really tell from the interiors in central Dublin, and they've both got, one's got a job and one's an art student, and they're just trying to get by in that very typical like struggling millennial way.
Yeah, so Danny's theory is that they've, you know, come from out of town for uni or whatever, and hence why they don't sound like Dubliners, and also they treat the city like somewhere to vomit more than somewhere to belong.
Yeah.
But something else I found so interesting about this show is that I think the way it's presented, we're supposed to think it's a comedy. It has the really chirpy title music. It has a lot of the framing reminded me of Broad City or the early series of Girls, like two young women breaking taboos, like peeing in front of each other, sharing a toilet cubicle, you know, having alcohol in their handbags, having a great time messing with the boys. I think it's deeply sad.
Yeah, well, I was having that same thought in my mind of like, is this a comedy? Not because this is sad, because I think a lot of my favourite comedies are also just like super bleak and about people living bleak lives, but because I was like, this has the lightness of a comedy, but I'm not laughing really. I'm not laughing out loud. Like, that's not to say that there was nothing that I found funny about this programme. There were moments that I found funny, but you know, maybe this is just my bias, but when I watch an episode of Girls, I like cry sometimes with just the sheer hilarity of performances from people like Andrew Rannells, who are just so funny to me. This wasn't at that level for me ever. It was so I was like, wait, are we meant to care about the affair this character is having, for example, or are we just meant to like laugh at the fact that she's got sick on her top? I'm like not quite sure.
Well, that's the thing, I didn't find it laugh out loud funny, and then at the end I watched the first two episodes and
you're further than me. I just watched the one,
and then at the end of each episode Danny and I would be like, so let's just recap for each other what happened, and we'd list the things. We'd be like, oh God, like this girl's, she has problems. She needs help. I feel sad that I just watched that, you know?
Yeah, true.
And there's a, I can't remember, is it in the first or second episode, her thing with the morning after pill?
Yeah, so she's sort of won't admit to herself that she's having a lifestyle of casual sex. So she doesn't want to be on the pill. So she's using the morning after pill instead as like her main form of contraception. And the nurse who's supplying her with it is sort of saying, maybe you should go on the pill. And she kind of wells up, doesn't she? Because she's like, oh, no, I'm not in a relationship. I don't want to go on the pill. And you sort of want to shake her and be like, look, this is not about judgment. This is about the practicalities of your life.
Yeah.
No one cares if you're like, quote, sleeping around. Like, that's not sad in itself. But it's her relationship with that fact is kind of internalized misogyny and sad in a way, right?
Yeah, I found that scene really moving, especially because I had Danny next to me being like, it's not even that easy to get the morning after pill in Ireland, you know. So yeah, I don't know, just lots of things about it sort of pushed the emotive button rather than the laughing button for me.
Do you think that's what the writers are intending?
So my best theory about this, based on no knowledge at all, is that it is what the writers intend, mm-hmm. and then the show has been packaged differently to how they wrote it.
Yeah, maybe. But I think it's an interesting piece of TV. And I do also think it's good to have some, like, programmes that are really rooted in a setting that isn't London, because we, although, you know, it's not like everything on the BBC is set in London, a lot of things on the BBC are set in London, and the ones that aren't, I feel like, often aren't necessarily, like, significantly about that the sense of place. Whereas it's been nice to see Cleek and this taking some, you know, outside of England, UK settings.
In a sort of youth-focused drama way as opposed to, like, a news way or a sort of issues-based drama way.
Yeah. And in a, like, what's it like to live in this city? Like, what's it like to deal with a city with, like, in Cleek, where they sort of talk about this almost, like, semi-aristocratic under part of Edinburgh that's, like, more obsessed with money and class. Like, what's that sort of part of the city like? And in this one, you get much more of a sense of what it's like to kind of, like, live in a city, you know, with lots of drinking. And, you know, I know that's a stereotype in lots of ways about Dublin, but exploring that aspect of, like, the party scene there.
Danny pointed me towards a reality show that was on, I think, about 10 years ago, called Fast Street, which is the name of one of the main streets in Dublin, which was like a Hills style scripted reality show about some well-off young women, mostly young people in Dublin. And she said to me, this is like a fictionalized version of Fast Street.
Interesting.
And she said that loads of people she went to school with and stuff were completely obsessed with that show. So that to me was interesting, that I think it's, you know, it's coming from a different place than just the BBC commissioners being like, oh, we haven't done an Irish thing for a while.
Yeah. One thing that I did think was good and also really horrible to watch was the sex scene they did.
Yes,
which was so Aisling has casual sex with some guy that she meets in a club, and he, like, seems really charming in the club, and, like, they almost get, the writers almost give you beer goggles because he's like dressed really nicely, he's got curly hair and he's handsome, and then he, like, takes her home to his older sister's house and he's like just, like, really, like, bad and, like, really uncaring and, like, won't put on a condom and, like, is really, like, shh, be quiet, my sister will hear, and, like, just seems like a baby, and it's like, oh, this whole thing has been a nightmare. And so I didn't find that funny because I was so uncomfortable. Well, but
there was one moment where I was quite close to laughing during that bit when, you know, he's, like, on top of her and stuff, and he's obviously having a good time, and he's like, are you gonna come? And she's like, no,
not at all. Not.
And that did sort of
make me she's kind of giggling as well, which makes it much easier to take, because you're not like, oh, this is a really horrible sexual experience for her. She's just like, this is a bit pathetic.
Everything in the way she was saying was like, you are bad at this.
Yeah.
And I am not enjoying it.
Yeah, so an interesting little comedy / sad piece of programming.
Yeah, continues the, I feel, the run for the new online only BBC Three of doing really interesting things.
Yeah, we're fans.
We're fans of them, and I hope that they carry on with this, you know, strand of things that are set outside London that maybe would never have got done when it was still a channel, when you couldn't, like, directly see how many people clicked.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mm-hmm. So last week, Caroline and I decided to listen to The Black Tapes, which is a podcast that's got like a paranormal mystery element, or it is a paranormal mystery show. I don't know about you, Caroline, but I was absolutely entranced by this very gripping documentary. It's fictional and we didn't realise it was fictional.
Yes, I know. So I got like 20 minutes in and I was like, is this like a really badly sort of scripted version of Serial? And then I googled and I was like, oh, it's fictional, they're all actors.
I thought it was like Crime Watch, where like they had like interviewed somebody, but because they were like doing some shady shit, they had to get an actor to like read out what they had said. Because the main person, to her credit, is like very, very authentic in her voice acting, and it sounds like you're listening to Sarah Koenig or someone in her delivery. So I was like, okay, this is real. This is the presenter of the radio show. And, you know, she says things like, as listeners to Pacific Northwest will know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So I was like, this is from a real radio station.
Pacific Northwest is not a real radio station. This is the thing I had to learn on Google.
No, so it's not.
This whole narrative that like Alex Reagan, the host of this one, is used to be on this other radio station and now she's doing this spin-off podcast project. I was like, all of it is made up.
Yeah.
That would have been helpful to know.
It was literally like Serial from This American Life. I was like, oh, cool. Like, whatever. Going along with it. She's great. She's like interviewing people, and then I'm like, god, this person she's interviewing is clearly reading her answers out from a piece of paper, so this is weird. So then I had like invented this whole like fantasy Crime Watch scenario where they were like it's so silly. It's a drama in the style of a documentary, like a lot of things that we have liked in the past. For me, I don't know whether it's because of that initial confusion that I found it less successful. Obviously that is really a sign of it being more successful, but I felt kind of like, oh it's fake.
Until I got to the bit in the first episode where they go on a ghost hunt with this academic that she's been interviewed, and they, you know, get in a situation where they're trying to reach a spirit, and it's like flash the blue light once for yes, red for no. And I did actually have a slight moment of chill at that bit when the producer accidentally like kicks over the lights or something, and I was like, "Ah, what happened?" Yeah. So it does have the capacity to like genuinely shock me a bit, but I think if I listened to a lot of it in quick succession, if I binged it, I think the stiltedness of it would I'd get used to it, like my ear would attune to it. I think it's just because I listen to so many podcasts that are genuinely non-fiction podcasts that are genuinely structured in this way, I'm very finely attuned to all the ways in which this stands out as people reading as opposed to responding naturally.
Yeah, and for me as well, there's this whole thing of like when you're listening to say something like Serial or, you know, S-Town maybe even, or you're reading like a long read and it starts with this kind of like digressiveness and it's like Stephen Furman's timber company was founded in a small town an hour away from Chicago in 1832, and you're like, okay, these facts are going to be important, and they like keep going with the spiel, like it changed hands in 1903, you know, when an insurance scandal gripped the town, and you're like, okay, yeah, following. With this I'm like, oh, what's the point? Can't you just like give me a shorter backstory, because it's not actually grounded in reality. And I have the opposite thing when I'm watching a movie, where I'm like, as we've talked about a lot of the time with our like biopic fatigue, where I'm like, oh my god, okay, there's a lot of backstory about this like illegal company here that you would just cut out of a fictional movie, but because it's real you feel like you have to keep it in. For me, I wish that this had been a bit like sharper around those edges. It feels like a lot of unnecessary information to digest and try and like puzzle over if it's actually just complete invention.
Yes, I know what you mean. I think maybe the attempt to pastiche and parody the serial true crime podcast.
It's very accurate, to be fair, like completely fair. It is extremely accurate.
It is, but I think maybe the desire to do that accurately has overtaken the desire to create
like a fun podcast.
Like a really fun podcast. Yeah. So yeah, I would say a good one to binge if you're maybe on a long car journey or a plane journey or something, but it's probably not one that I'm going to be like tuning in for every new installment.
Yeah, and maybe we've ruined it by like saying this is fictional, but for me, I think I'd actually prefer it to have gone in knowing that.
Yeah, me too. I think I would have had different expectations and maybe made different allowances for it and stuff.
Yeah. So next week we're thinking of talking about a book.
Yeah.
How fun. A book that's not actually out yet, so we'll probably have like a spoiler-free light discussion of whether or not we think you should read this book when it comes out. It's called Sympathy by Olivia Sudjic, and it's got a lot in there about like digital life and how that like interacts with your own just inner conscious mind. So that's kind of a lot of seriously-ish themes in there, so we'll enjoy it, I'm sure, but stay tuned to find out. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including iTunes, where you could also leave us a review if you want.
At our website, seriouslypod.com, you can find all our back episodes on Home Alone, Gilmore Girls, Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. We're SeriouslyPod on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. You can get in touch on social media or email us at seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.